It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Eli and Eatable. Shots fired.
Fugitive Task Force. We have shots fired at MOS. We have one U.S. Marshal shot, one perp down. Put a rush on the bus.
Welcome to Chasing Evil. I'm Chris Godzik. Today we're talking about the manhunt and apprehension of Andre K. Sterling. The deputy marshals hoped he'd go quietly. Andre Sterling had other ideas. With us today are five of the deputy marshals and one of the NYPD detectives who faced off with him on December 4th, 2020. Three of my guests were shot. One of them, five times. Get ready for the most candid, honest, and detailed conversation as we put the Andre Sterling case under a microscope. And it's because of our ability to have open discussions that our friends in the Marshal Service at the Office of General Counsel would like you to know U.S. Marshals True Crime Podcast is produced with the cooperation of the United States Marshal Service and contains interviews with current and retired employees, as well as other persons. Opinions, positions, and views expressed by any of them may not reflect the official views, positions, or policies of the U.S. Marshal Service. On November 20th, 2020, Massachusetts State Trooper John Lennon makes a routine traffic stop in Hyannis, Cape Cod, during which Andre Sterling shoots Trooper Lennon. The bullet goes through his hand and is fortunately stopped by his vest. Sterling flees the scene and disappears. Along with others, the people in this room tracked him down. We won't be using names today, but we will be using numbers. Later in the episode, we'll discuss the stack, which is the formation the marshals use to enter residences. The number we give each person today will correspond to their position in which they line up in the formation. That'll be for deputy marshals 1 through 6. And then there's number 10. Number 10 is our NYPD detective who is supervising the perimeter. You'll also hear other members of law enforcement being referred to as TFOs, or task force officers. Those are people that are not deputy marshals, but they've been deputized and they work under the auspices of the task force. Thanks for being here, everyone. Let's get right to it. We'll start with number one. Tell us about the Regional Fugitive Task Force and what kind of cases you guys get.
Yeah, so here in New York City and all RFTFs, we go after the worst of the worst, the most violent fugitives. In New York City, we cover, through the NYPD, our greatest partner here, we cover all homicide cases for the city. Every homicide case in which there is a fugitive or an outstanding perpetrator, that case is delegated to the task force.
So that's, you have NYPD, you have ICE, you have state troopers, you have other marshals assigned to other districts. You've got a lot of people working under this umbrella of the Regional Fugitive Task Force, right?
Yes.
The fugitive hunting, this is your bread and butter.
Yes, we're quiet about it. We want to be reserved, but we're the best at it.
So let's start at the beginning. Number five. Tell us, what did you know on the day? Who is Andre Sterling?
On the evening of November 21st of 2020, about 8:45, I got a call from the supervisor of the Fugitive Task Force in Massachusetts who told me that we were looking for the guy who shot John Lennon. Who, my impression was we had already caught that guy, but this was a new John Lennon and a new guy who shot him.
You guys don't have to muffle it. If he delivers a good one, give him props.
He told me that they had a shooting late the previous evening up near Cape Cod, which I'm told is fairly unusual for Cape Cod. It was a car stop. As the trooper was approaching the car, unprovoked, no hesitation, lit the kid up. The kid had been on the job for about 6 months, this trooper, who responded with extraordinary heroism. They then fled from the vehicle, and the investigation started right there at that vehicle.
Okay. It's been how many days before you were called in?
We were called the following evening. They identified their wanted subject, Andre K. Sterling, who has at least five AKAs that we know of, six or seven dates of birth, six or seven social security numbers, rap sheets in Massachusetts, Florida, and Wyoming, and an active warrant in Wyoming. All of it was narcotic stuff, a lot of marijuana trafficking. And now for the attempted murder of a state trooper. So what they told me was after fleeing the vehicle, Andre Sterling had gotten hold of another vehicle in Massachusetts. The vehicle had traveled south into New York to the city of Mount Vernon, which is a small city in lower Westchester County, right on the border of the Bronx. It's in the area that my team covers. So they told me the vehicle was in Mount Vernon and it was parked. They had a known location for it. So that was pretty exciting to us. So I called a couple of the members of my team and we responded to the area. Not really knowing what we were looking at. I mean, we knew this was a guy who had shot a cop. We didn't know much about his background at the time. Since the vehicle had been sitting for so long, my thought process was, one, maybe the adrenaline dump finally wore off and he's parked in the vehicle asleep. But by the time we got down there, which was closer to midnight, the vehicle was observed in Connecticut en route back to Massachusetts, where it was stopped by the state police.
Uh-huh.
This led us to an associate of Sterling's who eventually told us that she had been contacted by Sterling and another individual who directed her to take the vehicle back up to Massachusetts.
Right.
So at that point, the immediate trail went cold, and we had to start looking at Sterling himself.
So typically, when we get these fugitive cases, when they're delegated to us, we look at his criminal history. We look at his AKAs. Did he purchase those IDs? Are those IDs still being used? Do the people know that he stole those identities? What was the first name that he used in his first arrest? I had a TFO partner of mine teach me that, when I actually first started working warrants. If you have a career criminal, look at the first time he was arrested and look at the name that he used on his first time, right? And then look at his last arrest, and then, you know, you have a multitude of AKAs. We want to look at who visited him in jail, who bailed him out. We have enormous amount of databases, and then we're obviously in the digital age where, you know, whether it's a cell phone, social media, you have your digital footprint, and those are things that we look to exploit. Mm-hmm. They're extensions of us by nature. You know, your friend section on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, whatever it is, these are all your family tree. These are all patterns of life.
Right.
But, you know, the pattern...
And people don't usually separate from their pattern of life?
Well, obviously in the fugitive game, fugitive investigations, you want to identify the pattern of life. In this case, his pattern of life, I would say, was disrupted because, you know, he tried to kill a uniformed state trooper that was doing his job. And obviously that is, amplified on the media. It's amplified on the news. It's on your cell phone. There's billboards out there. Mm-hmm. So clearly what he was doing prior to that, it's disrupted his pattern of life, whatever that was.
Uh-huh.
So we want to find the new pattern of life. And then obviously disrupt that pattern of life with an arrest attempt, right? So when we do that, it's a fugitive investigation. It's adult hide and seek. So basically, we're trying to find him. And when we do that, we look at everything. We put it under a microscope. We look at what's the weakest link? Is there someone there that we can speak to? Is there, you know, someone there? Is there some type of technology that we can exploit? So these are all the things that we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as the identification aspect, in this case, this is an attempted murder of a state police officer. That's already been done, right? We don't have anything to do with the ID.
Right.
The case at that point is delegated to us. We have a warrant signed by a judge demanding his arrest, an accusatory instrument, and this is the legal lawyer fancy term for it.
Right.
And then from there, the hunt is on.
We're back to number five. You've been looking at the patterns of life.
So what the pattern led us to, the first most obvious one was the female associate who was caught in the vehicle that we knew he had operated from Massachusetts to New York. She, in turn, led us to multiple associates of Sterling's in the New York area. We ended up with an address in Mount Vernon. We ended up with an address in Queens. And we ended up with an address in the Bronx, all of which looked promising. So then digging deep into those addresses, we determined that there wasn't anything really that lit up one address precluding all the others. Mm-hmm. So the decision was made that we were just going to have to hit all of them simultaneously. We can't hit an address in Mount Vernon and then go to the Bronx and then go to Queens. The speed at which people can communicate now, there was no point to that.
Right.
And since you're looking for an attempted homicide suspect, a guy who obviously has no problem shooting at the police, every one of these enforcement operations needs to be treated. It needs to be organized like the Normandy invasion. You need to send 10 or 12 people to each of these addresses. So right now you're talking about close to 30, 40 investigators all working one case. It's a lot of people to coordinate. It's a lot of people to communicate with. Information is going to be changing constantly. New information is going to be coming in. It has to be put out to everybody. It becomes a huge logistical undertaking.
Okay. It turns out that he's not there, and this is for any fugitive case. It turns into, you know, a field interview. You know, so maybe you want to take your guy who's great at rappelling off of a helicopter with every type of tactical equipment and replace him with your guy that can, talk, and humanize himself with the people there to try to get you to find your fugitive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The address that we finally settled on, which had a slight edge over the others, was 4085 Ely Avenue, apartment 1R in the Bronx.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about Ely Avenue. What happens on the day?
It was a 5 a.m. tack, which means...
You don't just show up at 5 a.m. and get ready. You show up, if you're running the case, you show up at about 3:30, 4 a.m.
Okay.
And start putting this thing together. Because this was, even for what we do, ordinarily, I mean, when we do tactical training, we throw out a question to the group, what's the best number of people to hit a place with?
Mm-hmm.
And people who haven't done it a lot say, as many as possible. If you could get 100 people, you'd do that. Which sounds like the right answer until you start trying to organize it. So for this, we wound up with 34 people out there that day. 34 people to hit one address this is Bronx real estate. This is not, if that apartment was 500 square feet, I'd be surprised to hear that. This was not a huge place, but we had a huge number of people for it.
And you had some stateies down from Massachusetts.
Investigators came down from Massachusetts. People from the Massachusetts Task Force came down. People from various specialized units in the Marshal Service came down. NYPD, obviously, and I mean NYPD units not affiliated with the task force. We had their emergency services unit on standby. It's really the great strength of the task force that you can pull all these disparate elements together basically at the drop of a hat.
Mm-hmm.
But then it becomes a huge number of moving pieces that you have to get on the board and utilize effectively. I mean, in the Marine Corps, you get 34 people. They call it a platoon. They give you a lieutenant and two sergeants to run it.
Right.
And with us, it's a bunch of cops who are used to running their own stuff that you have to try to herd into some kind of cohesive element. I mean, we tried to organize this podcast this morning with 7 people. and it was trying to convince kittens to all get into the same box at the same time. So with 34 type A personalities, I mean, we all know what the A stands for. And so it was a lot to juggle and a lot to manage.
Okay.
So we meet early. Right. You find the first trick is to find a parking lot big enough to accommodate all the vehicles.
Right.
Because if you have 34 people, somehow they're going to show up in 40 vehicles.
Right.
And it's like organizing parking at the county fair.
Right.
Then getting people together, making sure everybody knows who we're looking for, why we're looking for them, what the person's background is, the extraordinary level of danger presented by Andre K. Sterling. And making sure that everybody's ready for that.
Calling all lovers of mystery. Prepare to don your detective hat in June's Journey, a free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. Take a trip in time to the glitzy 20s and play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. The thrill is endless with new chapters added weekly, allowing you to not only enjoy the detective adventure, but also to personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Now, number two and number 10, you almost didn't make this operation. Number two, you were enjoying a little vacation time. You haven't been at work much prior.
Yeah. I was off for the past 2 weeks. I was working on my house. I was like tearing it apart, tearing the floor. You know, when you're in work mode, you don't take care of yourself at all. No shaving, nothing like that.
Well, it's by the way, speak for yourself. I think other people... Personal hygiene is maybe more important than other people.
You do take a shower every day, but as far as like, you know shaving and all that stuff, you know, man, you just don't care. I got a phone call from my team leader, and me and him usually talk every day, and he's, you know, asking, hey, what's going on for tomorrow on Friday? He's like, hey, you know, we have a heavy hitter, which is, you know, somebody that shot a cop or something like that. That's what we call him. Mm-hmm. So I was like, you know what? I think I'm gonna show up. I'm gonna go hang out with you guys. Once we're done with the hit, I'll hang out with you guys. I haven't seen you guys in a while.
In my case, turns out my car was broken into that morning. Mm-hmm. So I reached out to number one. I said, listen, I don't know if I'll be able to make it. And when I heard his voice,
I gave a kind of a little bit of a pause, and I was like, well, is there any way you could still come? Because we really need you.
So, all right, let's get back to the tack. Everybody is showing up. This is a huge number of people. Everybody's making fun of one another. The first one I went on, I happened to wear a brightly colored shirt, and someone said, oh, at least we know who's going to get shot first. And that was very appreciated, because number one could have told me to wear a dark shirt the following day, but he chose not to. So
it's a phrase of endearment. It's not a term, but a phrase of endearment.
I don't know. You see a lot of black and blue and gray going around.
Yes, I noticed when I was like in a bright turquoise shirt. That I was standing out, and fortunately, I did convince number one to lend me a black shirt. And
I'm sorry, just to add to that, I think this is a right fitting moment in terms of the joking and just to put it in context. So with us in fugitive enforcement, which, again, this is just my opinion, it's the most dangerous thing that you can do, arresting someone that doesn't want to be found, arresting someone that doesn't want to be arrested, right? So we try to bring that temperature down by telling jokes. And there was a lot of funny jokes that day, before and after.
And during.
During.
And during.
You need that levity.
Yeah. Right.
You need the levity. You need the camaraderie. And you know what you're walking into. And you knew it was a double enforcement operation.
Yeah.
And you're like, all right.
So from what everybody said, tensions were high. As number two said, this was a heavy hitter. So everybody's arriving at the meet. Number three, you...
Number five, pull me aside. He says, do you mind coming with me to the location? Let's see how it's laid out. Let's see the front door.
There are a couple different ways to assess a place, like number three has said. You're looking for fire escape. Where do the windows face? Is there a fence around the place? Is it going to be difficult getting to the back? I remember thinking, because we're not the neighborhood demographic, so the concern is that we're going to heat the block up and we're going to blow this thing. But the alternative is not seeing the place and improvising when you get there. And I remember as walking, I remember thinking, wouldn't it be funny if Sterling walked out the door right now? Wouldn't that be funny? And then that wouldn't be funny at all. That would be absolutely the worst possible thing that could happen. But I had worked with number three before, dealing with what we call EDPs, emotionally disturbed persons, people who are just mentally interesting. And I felt confident having him there with me. It was part of the reason that when I saw him, I said, let's just do a quick run past the place and just get eyes on it.
So we go back to the TAC meet spot, and number five says, grab another deputy to go with you to the location and sit outside. Dress down. If Sterling walks out, follow him on foot. Look as discreet as you can. Don't wear anything bulky. But maintain your distance, call it over the radio, text, anything you can let us know.
Because we had this real concern about we're going to be standing here organizing the platoon, which is going to take longer than usual. And meanwhile, Andre Sterling is going to get up, have his coffee, pack his lunch, walk out the door, and just be gone. And we're going to miss him by a minute, mm-hmm. which
has happened before.
It happens not constantly, but it happens mm-hmm. enough to be a concern, and let's mitigate that. And the trade-off to that is you got to put two canaries in the coal mine, basically. You got to mm-hmm. take two guys and say just be the eyes and be the early warning system. You know, Andre Sterling had been confronted by one police officer before,
right,
in Cape Cod, and we saw how that turned out.
Right.
So is that going to happen again? That could effortlessly happen again.
Mm-hmm.
It's all a trade-off. It's all what can we – it's the kind of decision that sits with you. Like, what am I going to say afterwards if – you know, what do you say to somebody's significant other that, you know, hey, we really needed eyes on the place. How do you comfort somebody with that? You know, Jesus, if it's any consolation, hey, what happened to your loved one? It was statistically unlikely. So, you know, I don't know. I don't, handing people folded flags sucks.
Mm-hmm.
But it needed to be done. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know.
So I grabbed another deputy. I said, leave your car here. We park diagonally across from the house.
And how many people are, I mean, this is what, at 4 a.m., 5 a.m.?
It's probably 4:20, 4:30 a.m.
And how many people are active on the street?
There's some street walkers, you know, people right. walking up and down the block.
New York City never sleeps.
New York City never
That's
sleeps.
That's legitimate when they say that.
Probably about half an hour passed by, then on the radio says we're on our way to your location. At that time, me and the other deputy in the car got out. We went to the front door. We got through the front door. We propped to the second door. At that time, we're propping up the second door. The whole team formation fell into place.
So, number five, what are your thoughts in how you're going to approach the house?
Basically, there are two primary elements. You have entry and perimeter. Perimeter is people who are responsible for anything that comes out of the house or anything that happens outside the target location.
Okay.
And then entry is whoever's going in. Like we said before, we had enough people to film an episode of whatever a popular TV show is now among these young people. So I wasn't worried about the perimeter. And then the entry was primarily composed of an element in the task force we call the Bronx team. I used to work with them. I was moved to a different unit, so obviously their performance improved exponentially after that. So I knew that as an entry element, These guys were the best.
All right, let's take a second to discuss that formation known as the stack. It's something we've seen in every television show and every film ever made since the beginning of time. It's that line of people, one right behind the other, that we see when law enforcement or the military are ready to go into a residence. Why is the stack so great, and why do you still use it?
It works. It's
okay, thank you very much.
Next.
The stack is essentially an attempt to impose order on chaos, because the alternative is a mob. The alternative is the plan from Ghostbusters, get him, which
okay.
So up front is going to be your ballistic shield. Not only is it protection, but it's identification. It's basically a big billboard that says police. Right next to that is going to be what we call the long gun, which is an investigator armed with a rifle who is going to work in tandem with the shield. We mm-hmm. like the long gun because it defeats body armor because of its devastating capability, which gets overlooked in movies. A rifle fired just indoors is like a concussion grenade. And then the effects it has on living tissue is devastating. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most powerful man-portable weapon systems we have. In many ways, it's more effective than the shotgun. After that, you have people falling in, your communications officer, your team leader, your contact and cover officers, and then your breacher and your breacher cover. So that's
and the breacher
way.
Has?
Breacher uses a tool. It's what you see in movies. People, they'll use rams. It'll be the guy who kicks the door. It'll be the guy who takes what's called a Halligan tool, which is like a crowbar on steroids and takes the door. And now we're using a tool called the Agora, which opens doors like beer cans. It's basically the jaws of life in reverse. It tears fortified doors open like they're not
and
there.
And quietly.
So we're at the apartment. We have how many people outside around the perimeter?
25. We have an entry stack of 10 investigators.
Okay.
Up front is our shield and our long gun, which we refer to as number one and number two.
And everybody has numbers today for that reason. The numbers you hear us talk about
correspond to the order
in which people went into the apartment. And we're going to take you there.
Every case is dangerous, but when you have a police-involved shooting, you know the potential of violence is even greater.
Right.
And then you choose to still be in the stack because you want to end the reign of terror that this person is on.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you think about the mentality, it's bravery and responsibility. And most of the time, it equals success.
So we're coming together in a long, narrow hallway. This is almost routine because you guys go after people who are wanted for homicides weekly.
Yes, so we're getting ready to make entry. Typically, we knock, right? We're not doing a narcotic search warrant. We're arresting a fugitive. So we want to knock and announce. That's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Another team member knocks on the door. Typically, we like to call that a soft knock. Just sometimes it's, you know, two fingers. Sometimes it's the edge of your knuckles. We want to engage the door. We want to knock on that door and establish proof of life inside of the residence.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's very important. And then there's other assets that we have to help us gain that proof of life.
Mm-hmm.
Sensitive techniques that we use to make sure that there is a human being on the other side of that door.
Right.
So we did a soft knock that day. It was just a couple of knocks, right, number two?
Yeah, it was just a couple.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, and I'm on that door. And again, this is really small and confined, and number two is connected next to me, as typically the way that it is with number one and two. So we did a soft knock. The door opens. And as number five was explaining on the background of the case, there was an associate. His name was Granderson. He was the head of the household, right, number five?
And more importantly, we knew what he looked like.
Right. So we had a photograph of Granderson. He had a previous criminal history. It was it was 100% connection to the fugitive, Andre Sterling. So we knew we were going to encounter, Granderson at least. And we had already established that Granderson was not only an associate of the fugitive, but he was helping him.
This was not a casual acquaintance. This was not somebody that Sterling maybe reached out to. We knew that this person and Sterling were very, very close.
Door opens. It's Granderson. And, it's police, NYPD, U.S. Marshals. Go back. And at this point, he's compliant.
Mm-hmm.
He's listening to our commands, to my commands,
right,
to go back. I asked him, I was like, who else is in here, right? You know, you guys can all elaborate on this. How many times we'll knock on the door and someone comes up to the door and they're like, oh, I don't know where he is. And then it's like the wink and the gun, right? And then it's like they're pointing to the apartment. You know, I don't know where he is. They're getting down on their knees and they're like pointing to the room, or they're whispering, he's in this room over here.
Yeah.
We didn't get that here today, right?
Yeah, actually, it was like not today, no. That day. I remember seeing him like giving this kind of an attitude.
Anger. Yeah, he had an attitude.
And a man who was under duress, a man who had been forced by his associate who tried to kill a cop a week and a half earlier, he could have stepped out.
Right.
Thank God, I'm saved. The police are here.
Right.
Go.
Right.
He did none of that.
Right.
This was not a bystander.
Mm-hmm. So he lures you in.
When we went in, number one, talking about how small the apartment is, we had to take over the apartment right away. So we didn't have time, number one, number two, myself, didn't have time to actually stay there and interview him. We had to, go over him
and dominate
the room, which was in front of us, which we did right away. Dominate meaning we have to cover our corners in there, our open spaces.
So three and four follow close behind. Number five, where do you go?
Off to the side, there was a narrow galley kitchen. Nobody was addressing that, so I dumped into that.
Okay.
And I'm looking at that because we have found people in cabinets. We have found people in refrigerators. We've found people in ovens. If somebody doesn't want to go back. Yes. If somebody don't want to go back, they will be so astonishingly inventive with finding places to hide themselves. And this was a guy who obviously doesn't want to go back, who maybe he heard 34 car doors slamming out front at 5 a.m. and realized that doesn't mean his neighbors are having a barbecue. It means the police are here and it's on. He may have had all the time in the world to try to conceal himself someplace.
Right.
I remember me turning to my left and looking to my three and my four and saying to them, clear the rooms behind me. Clear the rooms
so
behind me.
So you passed two unopened doors.
I had to because I had to stay with my number one.
I'm the last person in the apartment.
Right.
I come in, and the first thing I'm encountered with is the two deputies, three and four, coming out of the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
My visual is I see Granderson on the floor being questioned by another Dewsome. Where is there anybody else here? Is there anybody else here? Seconds later.
Right.
Seconds. I don't even know if it was like, it could have been milliseconds.
So I should say that as they walked into the apartment, there was a little bit of a hallway, and one and two passed two unopened doors, and three and four went to those doors and cleared both of those rooms to make sure no one was there. And then as they turned to the right from the hallway, it opens up into a living room.
Yeah.
We didn't even call it a living room, right? Because, again, this is it's important to know this is really close quarters.
It's a very, very small room.
Right. So we have two doors in front of us.
And Granderson has told you guys, there's nobody here.
Right.
Yeah.
We have a door that is partially open, and then we have a door that's fully open.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So we're both calling it out, engage with the rest of the team, and everyone's finding work at
yes.
this moment.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to the viewport of the shield. I have my helmet, obviously.
The shield has a little...
It's like a 4x10 viewpoint, right?
Yeah. It's a very small viewport, but enough to see. And we train with that. We shoot like that with that shield. And then we're relaying what we see.
Yeah.
And in this case, are you exposed in the living room?
Yeah, we're definitely exposed.
I know I am.
Number two is definitely exposed. Clearly. as the rifle operator. So we're advancing, but both of these doors are next to each other.
Right.
Right. So we're advancing, but we're advancing towards the partially closed door.
Uh-huh.
Right. And as we're getting to the closed door, the door opens, and I see him through the viewport. It was no doubt in my mind that this is the perp. And this is where things slow down. And again, this is not something where he's running from like a far distance. This is close quarters, you know, right up on the door.
Right.
Right? Door opens, and he's running into me. And I see a muzzle flash. Yeah, so I'm being shot at this point, right? I felt something.
What, on the shield?
Yeah, I felt something. But again, now this is. This is where the adrenaline, not they call it an adrenaline dump, but this is where the adrenaline, infusion starts, right? So now this is on, right? Like so this is the perp. He's on me. He's shooting and he's pushing, okay? And I'm already engaged with him. And
what do you mean pushing you?
Yeah, he's on top of me with the shield, and I see him. I feel something, and then I see a muzzle flash, and I know I'm being shot. You know, we're being shot. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. So I just started unloading. I started
engaging.
I started firing as many rounds as I could, and then at that point, with him, I felt pushing me. Which again, you're connected towards me, and then
physically pushing you.
Physically pushing, shooting with that shooting, and I'm holding the shield. That's when I fell to the ground. I knew you, number two, were behind me. Clearly, I don't know what's happening behind me, but you know, I remember, falling back.
Mm-hmm. And what is it? What does it feel like when a round hits the shield?
Well. I didn't know what was going on. I felt something.
Right.
Not a tremendous amount. Muzzle shields typically don't endure rifle rounds. They cannot, right?
But rounds, no.
Yeah, but hand round, regular.
Handguns.
And when you say endure means what is that? What does that mean?
A rifle round will go through it like it's a T-shirt. A handgun round won't bounce off it. It'll kind of be absorbed.
Falling back, you know, I had felt you next to me, you know, and then we both fell.
You felt me, yeah?
I did, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Mind you, Chris, this is new to me. That's why I'm like, it's not new, but it's,
yeah,
we don't talk much about this.
It's worth saying that you haven't, as a group, gotten together and really sorted out the very details of this. You're hearing it as they're hearing it.
This is like a little puzzle for me where everything's get put together.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so you, I felt right next to you.
No, well, I remember going back. I remember falling back. I don't remember exactly, you know. I felt we were separated. That's when it was just it was you know, I thought you died at that point. I thought you died. I was gonna be there right with you, and the amount of gun, you know, firepower that was coming in our direction, as well as, you know, in the other direction, you know.
You feel like a lot.
Yeah.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And then I was on the ground at that point, and then and I remember falling to the ground. I was hitting my head. The shield fell on top of me. You know, I still had the helmet on, but yeah, it was.
Did you still have a view by any chance of the situation, or the shield fell on top of you and you couldn't see?
I couldn't see everything at that point. And then I you know, all the rounds and all the shooting was, to me, it felt like it was like on top of me, like over me at that point.
Like it felt like that for me too. Yeah.
Yeah.
When did you realize it was done?
It was an eternity for me, you know. In again, in my perception, in my opinion, I felt like it wasn't ending.
Mm-hmm. I started screaming.
Until at the very end, when I heard a voice, a loud voice.
So number four yelled, "Ceasefire! Ceasefire!"
What was going through your mind when you heard ceasefire?
I thought I was shot. Just again, I. It wasn't a foul smell. It wasn't like a foul odor, but you know, I felt the perp was on me, right? And it was like a distinct smell. I don't know if I want to get dramatic and call it, you know, the death smell, or, you know,
it's not dramatic. It's reality.
Calling him, you know, is this what evil smells like? Is you know, is this you know, is this Obia or you know?
I think we all smell that.
Yeah,
I appreciate you saying it.
The sulfur, you know.
I felt crazy. I felt crazy for a while, thinking that I was the only one that smelled that, because I didn't voice it to anybody.
It's a weird smell.
So it's nice to know.
You can describe
it. And it wasn't. And there's some military people here too. It was not. And there's firearms experts here. It wasn't
gunpowder.
I'm talking about. It's a different type of smell.
Yep.
And then I slowly started, because then when I stood up, and then I started finding work again. Who shot? Number three looked up at me. I remember him saying, you know, I'm shot. And then he mentioned number two's name and said, number two shot. And then...
But did you check yourself before you did that?
I didn't. It was just like I'm standing up, and then that's because I typically, at least how I've been taught, I try to carry two radios, and the reason for that is, you know, we use NYPD radios or NYPD frequency where we talk on attack, which is like point to point.
Right.
But that point to point is atrocious. Where it only, you know, works like when we're like next to each other.
Right.
And we've tried to get repeater channels for that, but for whatever reason, that has failed. So I keep the division precinct channel on, and the reason for that is, you know, we call what's called as a 1013.
And what's 1013?
1013 is, you know, officer shot. Right. Signal 13, 1013.
Everybody and your mother.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Okay. Number two.
Yeah.
Being on the long gun, you're in the living room.
Mm-hmm.
And you're glued to the number one. And what was your perspective?
Number one, again, he covered the room to the right, mm-hmm. and I covered the room to the left.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when I was covering it, I put the light in there. I had, you know, flashlight on my rifle, so I put the light on that room that was wide open. Put it in there, and all I remember is seeing somebody running really fast. Somebody running with a white shirt,
mm-hmm.
running towards us. Mind you, I had so many cases where we get individuals that they come out of rooms running.
Right.
We're not a hit squad. We're not assassins. We're law enforcement, so we always have to assess the situation.
Right.
And in my mind, I remember thinking, okay, he's running. And again, everything slows down. I mean, slow down completely. And this is me watching him running towards me and in a slow, slow motion. And I'm seeing powder.
Right.
Powder coming out while he's running towards me. And I'm thinking, okay, trying to put two and two together. And then I put two and two together when I felt the pain on my leg.
Right.
And I was like, okay, he's shooting at me. Then once I put those two together, which was pain on my leg, which was excruciating, and the powder, the black powder coming from him mm-hmm. running towards me,
mm-hmm.
I started engaging him with my rifle. Again, everything slowed down, and I remember vividly my trigger finger
right.
pulling the trigger twice.
Right.
I remember vividly. And I remember stopping. When you do a rifle and you get stoppage or it just not shoot anymore, it just won't click anymore. I remember cursing that rifle. And I'm thinking to myself, I just cleaned you. I just cleaned you last week. You're clean.
The gun. The rifle.
Yes.
It's clean.
Because I'm saying, you're clean. You're
mm-hmm.
you should be working.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I got so, I was already pissed because of that he shot me on the leg. And I remember thinking, I was pissed at it, and I remember just throwing the rifle on the floor. Well, when I did that, I threw it on the floor, and then I immediately transitioned into my handgun. When I transitioned into my handgun, I remember it felt weird. Once I took my handgun out, it felt right. weird when I was holding it. Again, all this is in slow motion from the get-go, from the time that he got out of the room. So I took it out. I start, you know, start looking for my target.
Right.
But I remember again thinking something doesn't feel right in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
Something doesn't feel right. So I remember looking at my hand, seeing my pinky like hanging. And there was blood in there. I was like, seeing my pinky hanging. And I remember thinking, oh, okay, this is why it feels weird. And I remember again looking at my trigger finger and, you know, moving it in a motion like, okay, I can still use it to pull right. the trigger. I was, okay, this one still works.
But you didn't feel the shot to
No, that pinky. The only one that I felt
right.
out of all the other ones that I was hit is the leg one. That was the only one that I felt. But that one I didn't feel. So I remember, again, I remember looking at my hand and looking at my trigger finger, and I was like, okay, this one still works. We're still good to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was about to... I punched out, and I was about to start picking him up. I had him on my side. Mm-hmm. I was about to pick him up again, and it was lights out. I remember it was lights out.
Lights out for you.
Lights out.
I look at number six. Number six takes a bullet right by her face. Wall blows up.
I'm getting knocked backwards, and all I see is the round going by the side of my left side of my head in – You talk about slow motion, like you could feel like the air waves. You just see it going by the side of your head as you're going backwards, as the person in front of you is coming back on top of you, which was mm-hmm. my number two.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to make that decision of where you're going, what you're doing. And my decision at that moment was the only safe place for me, because I had no sight lines to the fugitive,
right.
was to holster my weapon as I'm going backwards. So there's no accident.
Uh-huh.
So one thing that the Marshal Service teaches you and ingrains in you is like, hey, guys, there's going to be a point in time in your life where you're going to step over your brother, your sister. You're going to step over their lifeless body in a firefight. But you're going to know and understand and realize that whoever that person was to you, they're gone. And I'll never forget the fact that I looked down on his lifeless body when he got shot, and he took one to the chest, and he went limp, just limp. And I stepped over him, and I say, hey, number two's gone, in my mind.
Right.
And I had to turn that emotion to, like, it's time to get into the firefight.
Right.
Let's go. You know?
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Check out our great selection of garage and utility lighting options. In stock, ready to take home today. We carry everything to help you illuminate whatever project you're working on. Shop garage and utility lighting products in store at your nearest Menards. You can also view all of our entire selection of lighting options today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
The perp and I were exchanging rounds, and the gentleman to my left ended up taking a round to the leg. So when he ends up taking a round to the leg, he inadvertently grabs me and drops me.
Right.
I thought at the time I got shot.
Right.
But I didn't know.
Right.
Because I just fell.
Mm-hmm.
But I kept returning rounds.
Right.
Sterling fell at my feet. When he fell at my feet, the last thing I remember him was pointing a weapon towards my team leader's face.
Mm-hmm. So he was still
going. Glock.
Right.
He was still going.
Right.
And that's when I unloaded a round into his head. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget it.
Mm-hmm.
As I did that and I watched around strike into his head, I watched his body go lifeless. I watched his finger go off the trigger. I yelled at the top of my voice, ceasefire, ceasefire, stop, stop, ceasefire.
And I remember it's so funny how we're trained, and I think number five can put into that, we're training when we go to the range, we always train, okay, whoever says ceasefire,
stop,
everybody stops. And stop, it's like an automatically thing that we have in our heads already. And I remember the drop of that and everybody stopped. As soon as I said ceasefire, 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 everybody stopped.
It was the eeriest feeling.
It was quiet. It was very quiet.
As we're recovering.
Everybody's doing something.
Everybody's finding work.
Right, right.
So my number one's yelling as he's picking up his shield. He's yelling. He's like, yo, we got to go. We still got unknowns.
Right.
Who's hit? That apartment, it was like, who's hit? And I remember raising my hand. I was like, I'm hit.
I realized I got to get up. I couldn't get up. I looked down. And at that time, I had Andre Sterling, his dead body on top of me. So I'm pushing him off and pulling myself out. And then that's when I saw the hole in my leg, blood coming out. And I said, I'm hit.
As they left, we hadn't cleared those last two rooms. And again, training kicked in. If I had designed the scenario, if I were trying to make this a teaching point, I would put another role player in one of those rooms with a gun to wait for people to turn their back and get distracted, and then the second person would come out and get a free lunch. So I'm like, so let's not let them do that. So I and another investigator posted up and covered those doors, and then we got more people in. We cleared the rest of the place.
I grabbed number three by his soft little dinky vest and drag him out. And his vest breaks on the way out.
Right.
His vest breaks. Like I grabbed him by the shoulder strap, the left shoulder strap on the way out, and it broke. And then he was like putting his gun away, and I'm like, no, you keep your gun out. Keep your gun out because we don't know what's going on down. We don't know what's happening. I said, you keep your gun out. So he kept his gun out, and I grabbed him by the collar of his shirt, and I kept dragging him back. And then I had asked number three, I said, where's your tourniquet? Where's your tourniquet? And he's like, I don't know. So I said, screw it. I gave him my tourniquet. And then I got it on him, strapped it to his leg because it was his upper left leg where he was shot. Got it on him. And then I went searching, as he said, you know, searching for other. It's more of a, let's see if we find any more holes.
Right.
We didn't find any more holes.
So I was on the outside perimeter, and I ran back in. I noticed number three standing on the staircase that went up in this residential building. And he was leaning there, but I saw the blood on his leg. And I said, are you shot? And he said, yes. I said, let's go. He said, I can't get over them. So I leaned over them, and I said, get as close as you can, jump up. And he jumped on my shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when we turned, exited the building as we were going down the stairs. The stairs gave way. We ended up against the wall. I pushed him forward. Other MOS were coming through the door. They aided him the rest of the way to the van. Another NYPD detective said to me when he noticed that I grabbed my leg, are you okay? And I said, I think I broke my leg. And he said, well, let's go to the hospital. And I said, well, let's go back inside first to see if the guy's okay. And as I attempted to, the adrenaline is flowing, you think you could still go. So I'm attempting to go back inside, and then, the training kicks in. If you can't be a help, don't be a hinder.
Mm-hmm.
So I went, and I said, it's time to go to the hospital.
Right.
So I remember just raising my hand. I was like, hey, I'm hit. I'm hit, guys. I'm hit. As soon as I said that, I remember they yanked me right away. I was expecting for them to, hey, come on. Let's get up, come on, let's hop out, let's just walk out of here, But no, it was yanked, like very, very violently, yanked me out.
Number six looked at me and said, we gotta go.
and you guys did.
So I make a demand, it's gotta be met.
And you guys did. So
I looked at you and I was like, the fact that you're awake, you're alive, and you just said something.
It felt violently.
That's why I yelled at you. I was like, yo, get your gun up.
I don't remember you saying that to me. I remember instantly, and I don't know if you had to say that to me or not. I don't know if you did, but I remember me thinking, I have to cover this guy. So I kept it on him, and I remember going back to that day, he yanked me violently out of there. They were dragging me out, and he got to the point in the doorway of the entrance. I was stuck in there.
Right.
My gun belt got stuck. Yeah. So they couldn't move me. So I remember telling them, I was like, hold on, stop, hold on. Let me do it myself. And that's when I found out I was shot on my left arm.
Right.
Because I tried to use it and it wasn't anything. It was like noodle there. That's all it was.
Out of service.
Out of service completely. So then I was like, okay, I put my gun on the floor, and then I used my right hand to pull me up. So I did that, and they put me in the small hallway that we talked earlier. Well, actually, they put me more towards the front entrance or the entrance of the building itself. And they started working on me. I remember thinking, my first thought was the medical training kicked in. I mean, I remember always some of the instructors that we had, one of the things that stuck to me is that you have to calm everybody.
Right.
Is in your best advantage to keep everybody calm.
Because they were looking at you they've seen better days.
If you're freaked out, everybody's going to freak out.
Right.
So that was my first thought. My first thought was, okay, calm down. And my first thought is, you need to bring your heart rate down too, because you don't want to bleed out here.
Right.
I was like, bring it down, talk softly, just don't hype yourself. So that's when I started instructing. I was like, hey, man, where I knew I was hit, which was on my, I told them, hey, I got hit on my leg, my left leg. I got hit on my left arm. My right hand is hit, but don't worry about that. It's just hand. And I said, yeah, do what you got to do. And they started working on me. I remember they did. And it got to a point that they pulled my pants down because they couldn't get to that. They needed to see it, of course.
Right.
So they pulled my pants down.
And did you know that the wound on your leg hit an artery potentially?
No. Well, when it got to the point when they pulled my pants down,
right.
And it got to a point that I saw the squirt on my leg. And I remember thinking, about that movie Black Hawk Down. There was a part in the movie Black Hawk where a soldier gets shot on the leg. So I'm going back to that. I'm like, oh, you know, he got my artery. I'm done because I saw the squirt.
Right.
And I saw his face too. I saw number four's face.
Right.
Like me and him looked at each other.
It hit my face. I'm pulling his pants down and hit my face.
Me and him looked at each other like, oh, this
is so the blood comes out with force.
Good. Yes.
So I threw a tourniquet on his leg and the tourniquet didn't work.
Right. Because he's too high up on the leg?
No. So the tourniquet... So the dial on the tourniquet, when I was trying to seat the tourniquet on there, there's like a little screw on it.
Right.
And when I was trying to get it on it, and I was like, I jacked it up, and I was turning on it. It wasn't working. And I threw it across the room.
Right.
And I looked at, you know, my teammate, and he just looked at me, and he goes... What now?
Like, me and him are thinking the same thing.
Right.
Pretty much.
This is very fatal. This is Black Hawk Down. This is like, we got 20 seconds or less.
Right.
And I looked at him and I told him, I was like, hey, man, I'm sorry. This is going to hurt. And I stuck my finger right into his leg. Couldn't find his exit hole. Stuck my finger right into his groin.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've met number six, her hands are bigger than me. Oh, Bean's bigger than me.
Mini mom.
And
Chris, I think my hands are bigger than yours.
Yeah. Yeah, as you know, she made you feel small, right? So
that's a whole other podcast.
And she's smaller than both of us, right? And I looked at her and I said, "Hey, get your fingers in that hole."
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I took my finger out of his groin. She ended up plugging his finger and making a bigger hole inadvertently that I had to deal with afterwards.
Right.
Because her man hands.
Again, when she did that, they plugged me in. And all I remember, another friend of mine that was there too, he picked me up.
Broke your arm.
Yeah, he picked me up when they decided, like, okay, we're leaving now. He picked me up. They carried me and picked me up from my left. And I remember I started screaming at him. I started arguing with him, cursing him out, because I thought he broke my arm.
The doctor said, hey, if you don't get number two to the hospital within X amount of minutes, he's done.
Right. So you carried him out. You got him.
So we're carrying him out. It's December. I yelled at the RMP, the Radio Mounted Police Patrol, and I said, hey, turn the heater on, because I knew my partner's losing blood.
Right.
Shock will kill you. A shock will kill you.
100%.
Just a shock blow.
So I yelled at those NYPD guys, and this it's 17 degrees outside. I'm in a t-shirt. He's naked pretty much because we cut all his clothes. Yeah. We cut everything off. And I was like, turn on the heater. As soon as we get into the back of the RMP, number six tries to jump in with me. And I
didn't want to let go of the hole.
Right.
I
you had to yell me off him.
I mule kicked her. When I mean I mule kicked her, think about a donkey kicking a person.
Okay.
I mule kicked her off of it, and I said, hey, close the door. We're good. She closes the door. It's just number two and I. So he's bleeding out. And him and I are talking. We're having a good time for what it for the terrible situation for what it is. We're having a good time,
right?
Yeah.
And he looks at me. He goes, "I don't know my wife's phone number. Do you know her number?" And I said, "I don't even know your wife. I don't even know my fiance's number. So like we're stuck in the same boat,
right?"
And that's when he died on me.
And when you say he died.
He flatlined on me, sternum rumbling, didn't wake up, stuck my finger back into his hole, his tourniquets came loose, so I had to retighten his tourniquets.
And this is what, they driving erratically, like, you know.
We're driving over 100 miles an hour in the streets.
Right.
Of New York City.
In the Bronx.
At 5:20 in the morning.
Yeah, and we got to give it to the NYPD the way they set up the route.
Because Because right.
And we have the audio for that.
I mean, yeah, so they close all
that will
the
be on the
way.
So
there.
You're in the car. He's died.
He flatlined on me.
Right.
Okay. I don't remember that.
And you're trying and you're trying to revive him. A sternum rub, which
doesn't work.
Which is to cause pain, some reset, pain stimulus.
A ridiculous amount of pain right. to your chest that you would wake up. He didn't wake up. His eyes were open. I did not feel comfortable flicking his eyeball.
Mm-hmm.
So I punched him in the face.
And when you say punched him, like you mean?
I cold cocked him as hard as I could.
You don't hit
the
heart.
I mean, we could give a demonstration, but I don't know if podcasters would visualize
He really doesn't hit the heart because I don't remember having any pain afterwards at all. There's no pain in my face at all. There wasn't anything. Just so you know.
Hey, hey! I'm glad you say that now because when it happened, you're like, "Hey, what does my face hurt?"
So you punch him in his heart as you can in his face.
I punched him in his face,
and he wakes up.
Not only does he wake up, he wakes up laughing, and he says, "Hey, buddy, what's going on?"
Right.
I say, "Hey, number two, stay awake. We're almost there." And he tells me, he's like, hey, this is the longest ride I've ever had in my life.
Right.
So I yell at my counterparts, my NYPD guys. I was like, yo, how far are we? He goes, hey, we're a block and a half away.
Right.
We're a block and a half away. And I yell at number two, and I was like, hey, dude, we're almost there. Just hang on.
Right.
And he says, yeah, no problem. We overshot.
The entrance?
The entrance, because they were going over 100 miles an hour.
Right, right.
That we overshot it. We almost flipped. We almost died getting there because right. when he died on me, I said something.
Right.
And those two gentlemen that were driving,
right.
One person was dealing with the sirens. The other guy was driving. True professionals, and they barely had 2 years on, yeah. 3 years on.
Rookies,
wow,
rookies, kids. Like wow. We look at them now. We got there, and I told number two, and I was like, "Hey, we're here."
This kid opens the door to drag me out, and my first thought was like, "If they drop me on that side, I'm gonna hurt too much."
Right.
I was angry. I was angry the whole time, as it is. I really was.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got there, I was still angry, of course. And I said, I saw this kid, this short, chubby kid, trying to pick me, trying to grab me, drag me out. Right. And like I said, the first thing I said to him, and I apologized to him after I saw him. I said to him, I'm sorry, I didn't know you were a cop. I said, don't you drop me, you fat ML. Like, if you drop me, I ain't going to hurt you, this and that.
Right.
So,
right.
I remember they put me in the stretcher. Once they put me in the stretcher, I mean, my first thought was, okay, I'm good to go.
Right.
And my first thought was, okay, if I ever passed out, they're going to bring me back.
You spend how long in the hospital?
I arrived at the hospital Friday early morning, and I didn't leave until Tuesday afternoon.
And how long did it take you to rehab to get back to work?
A year. And I'm still working through it.
Really?
The pain is still there. It's not going to go away. I got limited movement on my left arm, the elbow.
Mm-hmm.
The elbow was destroyed completely. They had to put it together. And I have 32 screws and 5 plates on my left arm. That's what I do. That's what I have right now. No one talks about the recovery process. The recovery process is very hard. You know, this is not like in the movies that you get shot in the arm and, you know, you just go back to be normal the next day. No, it was very painful. It was a very painful process. To me, the physical therapy was a lot. It was more painful than just getting shot. I mean, I will get shot any time of the day than go to physical therapy. 1,000%.
Right.
It's horrible. I hate it with a passion.
I hope that you... Number 3, number 10, and number 1 all continue your physical recoveries. And we haven't even addressed the impact that this experience could have on your mental health. It's an incredible story. Thank you to everyone for letting our listeners into your world and your private thoughts.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for this.
We're going to wrap it up with some final thoughts. And in lieu of our normal thank you, we have a very special dedication.
Just, I mean, I know we're wrapping it up, but just one last word that I always want to put out. It just to law enforcement people that are listening out there, is just, you got to keep fighting. And if you do encounter a situation where you get shot, just remember that scene from Dodgeball. You know, you got to get hard. You got to get mean.
Dodge, duck, dip. Dodge, duck,
dip. You have
dip.
To.
You know what? Of all the movies that I thought might come up during this podcast, Dodgeball wasn't one of them.
You just have to. You really have to get mean, you know, get angry. It will keep you alive. And just don't give up. Just because you got shot, you can still work. You can still do right. your job and defend yourself and just finish the job too.
Andre Sterling was shot approximately 10 to 12 times, I'm told. In this situation, after taking 10 to 12 rounds, and you've been in 4+ shootings, what is your experience, and what do you want to say about stopping the threat?
My current partner, who's a NYPD detective here, and you know, I'm talking to him, I was like, I remember engaging with him. You know, I remember you know, letting rounds go, and I know number two did as well. You know, I felt it, right? How come this perp just did not expire at that moment? And he said just one word: adrenaline, right? And in just the same way we have adrenaline going inside of a residence, so does perpetrators, right? And this was the ultimate gun battle. This was the ultimate adversary, armed adversary. You know, the typical Hollywood, well, why didn't you shoot him in the leg? You know, I used to, I watched all the Lethal Weapons. I love them. I adore them. And I remember the scene, yes. You know, Briggs and Murtaugh.
Briggs.
And, you know, oh, you really are crazy. Well, you know, and then in the one scene where Danny Glover tells Mel Gibson, he's like, I'm a good police. I try to shoot them in the leg. You know, I wish it was that simple, right? We all do. Like, you know, you shoot them. I mean, and we have other, you know, less than lethal gear and equipment that they give us, tasers and other assets that we have. But, you know, none of those things could have worked that day.
The point of all the training we do, we've talked a lot about training today. The point of training is to take the extraordinary and make it routine. Make it so that people who find themselves in impossible circumstances, they don't have to waste time being shocked by it. They don't mm-hmm. have to waste time being baffled by what they should do and just treat it like, oh, I've been in situations like this before. I've been in 20 feet from where we're sitting. The task force has built a modular shoot house that we can reconfigure into rooms, into hallways, into doorways, into windows, into little houses, and run people through them and train them. We go in there, we fire off what are called simunition rounds, which are little bullets made of paint or blanks, just so people can be in enclosed circumstances with gunshots going off and with projectiles whizzing past them, and in a training environment, so that out in the real world, when the balloon goes up, they don't have to, oh, this is something new, this is something I've never had any experience with. It can feel like, okay, this is like the shoot house. This is, and in the shoot house, I did this and this, and it worked out. I remember the day thinking, hearing that endless, that rolling, the gunfire that felt like it went on for about a year. I remember thinking, Jesus, that sounds just like Simrans. That sounds just like blanks. That sounds like mm-hmm. the way blanks ricochet off the walls. Okay, this feels like training. It feels like you put a scenario together and you're putting the class through it, and they're getting to the last room, and you know that's where the role player with the blank firing gun is. So, okay, in about 5 seconds, I'm going to hear boom, 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 boom. Then we're going to call out a roll, and that'll be that. And it felt like that level of calm. Mm-hmm. And watching all these people I've had the honor to work with and the honor to train, watch them do all that and react so perfectly as they'd been taught was extraordinary to me.
One thing that really struck me was what you told me that happened to you prior to the shooting.
So, I believe it was probably a year before, a few months before the shooting, Officer Anthony Dia was killed in line of duty. So his last radio communication was, tell my family I love them. you could Google his name and you could hear the audio clip. And I told my wife, I said, I don't want to go out like that. I said, you know, I love you every day. But the way that the world's coming, I'm going to get shot. She's like, nah, don't talk like that. Don't say things like that. I said, it's bound to happen. I said, I know a lot of guys that got shot, a few that got killed, a few that even committed suicide with all the things that went on. So for over a year, I was telling her, I'm going, you know, I'm going to get shot. She's like, ah, no, you're not. I said, I got to write a note. I said, I got to write you something because I don't want to leave you in the wind. So probably about a few months before this incident happened, I sat down on my laptop, spent probably about 3 hours writing basically my end of watch letter to her and my daughter, saying I love them.
Thank you. All of the participants in this episode would like to dedicate it to one of the NYPD's finest. He was there the day of the Andre Sterling shooting, but unfortunately is no longer with us.
So that day, there was another exceptional human being that was there. His name is Sergeant SDS Cornelius Douglas, TFO, NYPD TFO. Sadly, he passed away on the day of his retirement party after giving 36 years to the city of New York and the United States as a TFO and also as a sergeant with the police department. He was a legend. He was an icon. He was revered. He would be here with us. Sadly, he's not, but he's here in our memory.
Because he fought through cancer.
Yep.
And never complained once about it.
He was just a good human being, and we love him. We miss him. And as number 10 was talking about earlier, it really, this job, it's a calling, but it can be taxing on you, right? Particularly now in these times, and all you have is each other. So as number 10 was talking about, that was his sergeant, that was his partner for decades. And that's all you have leaving this job is the partnership, the brotherhood, and the friendship with each other and the memories. So we want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to remember his name and his legacy.
Yeah. He was, you know, he was Dougie to all of us. He was Cornelius J. Douglas to his wife Karen and his family. And he was a great cop, even better sergeant in the New York City Transit Police Department originally. And then when we merged departments in 1995, he became a sergeant. He was involved in the shooting where we lost a fellow MOS in the Bronx, New York, Kevin Gillespie. And he earned a combat cross in that. He was involved in shootings while in the Warren Squad, and he earned a combat cross in that. And more than anything else, he didn't speak of himself and all the accolades that were given to him that he experienced. He always spoke on his detectives' work that they did in the department, and he always wanted them acknowledged for it. All the way up until his last day, he wanted to see one of his teammates, one of the detectives he supervised, get promoted. Dougie and I were together in Transit District 3 when he became a brand new sergeant in 1993 and worked the midnights, and our careers, you know, crossed paths again after the merge. I went to the Bronx. He went to Bronx Warrants after his involvement in the shooting. And then I became a Warrant Squad detective. And I went on the career path in 1999. In 2001, I got promoted, and he was my sergeant from that day all the way up to his day of retirement. Under his tutelage, I was promoted 3 times. I reached the pinnacle of the NYPD detectives, first grade. And I was able to be here in the task force as a deputized member of the U.S. Marshals Service for 19 years. And he was my sergeant the whole time. So anything that I accomplished professionally and through friendship was integrity and respect. They could be attributed to who was leading me. And that was Cornelius J. Douglas, Dougie.
And finally, Chasing Evil is produced with the cooperation of the United States Marshal Service and contains interviews with current and retired employees as well as other persons. Opinions, positions, and views expressed by any of them may not reflect the official views, positions, or policies of the United States Marshal Service. Stay safe, everyone.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early, so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.